Andrew Sadek was a 20-year-old college student attending the North Dakota State College of Science in 2012. Often described as shy and timid, Andrew was a high-achieving student pursuing a career as an electrician. He balanced his time between attending classes, spending time with his roommate, and assisting his parents on their cattle ranch in Rogers, North Dakota. By all accounts, he was intelligent and kind, hardworking, and highly interested in building a future. All of that changed during his spring semester in 2013. In the spring of 2013, Andrew had begun selling marijuana to make some extra cash. In April of that year, he sold marijuana to a police confidential informant on two separate occasions. 7 months later, the day before his 20th birthday, on November 21st, sheriff's deputies arrived at his dorm and informed him that they were aware of his side business. With his consent, they searched his dorm room and found a plastic grinder with marijuana residue on it. Rather than arrest him, Andrew was asked if he was interested in working things out without having to go to court, and if so, he was invited to come down to the Richland County Sheriff's Department the next day to discuss his options. The next day, Deputy Jason Weber presented Andrew with two options. He could go forward with the charges, two Class A felonies for selling marijuana, which each carries a sentence of 20 years, or he could agree to become a confidential informant for the department and make a series of controlled buys, wherein a drug task force would monitor the purchases in order to make larger arrests further down the line. Faced with possible jail time or a nearly clean slate, Andrew agreed to undertake the operation. Within the first 2 months, Andrew made buys from two separate individuals and only had one person left to buy from, when suddenly, he severed all contact with Deputy Weber and refused to cooperate. By February of 2014, Andrew was no longer working for the Sheriff's Department, and as per his agreement, warrants were possibly going to be taken out for his arrest on the original drug sale charges. Andrew maintained secrecy about his arrest and his work as a confidential informant, with not even his parents being aware of the situation he was in. In April of 2014, a year after the sales for which he was originally arrested, Andrew went to visit his parents for the last weekend of the month. Then, suddenly on May 1st, Andrew vanished mysteriously. He was seen exiting his dorm at 2 a.m., but after not returning for 2 days and failing to attend any of his classes, he was reported missing to campus police. While Andrew's parents firmly believed he had become the victim of foul play, police considered the possibility that he was running from the drug charges. In the midst of their search efforts, they issued warrants for his arrest. 2 months later, in June of 2014, Andrew's body was recovered from the Red River just across the state line into Minnesota, some 5 miles from where he had last been seen. The cause of death was a small caliber gunshot wound to the head. Several strange details were unveiled about the condition of his body and the clothes he was wearing when he was found. A bitter debate between Andrew's family and the Richland County Sheriff's Department would play out in the media about whether or not Andrew was the victim of homicide or if he had committed suicide. Revelations about his work as a confidential informant would lead to a changing of the laws and a still pending lawsuit. What happened to Andrew Sadek? Was he murdered by one of the drug dealers he'd informed on? Did a crooked cop kill Andrew to prevent him from talking about things he had witnessed during his time with the task force? Or did Andrew, overwhelmed by the pending charges and feeling hopeless, take his own life in an attempt to put everything to rest? This is Trace Evidence, Episode 15, The Unexplained Death of Andrew Sadek. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today's episode focuses on the unexplained murder of 20-year-old Andrew Sadek, a college student turned police confidential informant. It's not a case which has received major coverage, and despite the strange twists and turns, it has been widely ignored by the media. Before we move into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on missing persons and unsolved murders. We are available across multiple platforms and on iTunes, Google Play Music, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and more. Trace Evidence has a Patreon for those of you who wish to support the podcast. It can be found at patreon.com/traceevidence. This podcast is a complete one-man operation, so if you enjoy it and wish to help support it, please check out the Patreon. I've received several new patrons this month and will be doing the August Patreon shoutouts in episode 16. Links, information, and more items, including YouTube videos and full episode transcripts, can be found on our website at trace-evidence.com. The website was completely overhauled this past week and relaunched a few days ago, so if you haven't looked in a while, take a moment to check it out. If you'd like to contact me, you can email me at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Tweet me at traceevpod, that's TRACEEVPOD, or join the Facebook discussion group simply by searching for Trace Evidence Podcast or clicking the direct link on our website. If you have questions, comments, or case suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. If you enjoy the show, please rate and review us on whatever app or platform you're listening on. The more ratings and reviews we get, the easier it becomes to find the podcast, and the more attention can be given to these cases. Today, we look into the unexplained murder of Andrew Sadek. This case involves several strange items and has caused a heated debate between Andrew's family and the Richland County Sheriff's Department. They're currently engaged in a wrongful death lawsuit with the family holding the state and the Sheriff's Department responsible. This is episode 15, The Unexplained Death of Andrew Sadek. Andrew Sadek was born in Valley City, a small town of less than 7,000 seated in Barnes County, North Dakota, on November 22, 1993. He was raised in Rogers, about 26 miles away, on a cattle farm owned by his parents, John and Tammy. Andrew was described as a shy, quiet kid who avoided trouble and kept mostly to himself. He had one sibling, an older brother named Nicholas, who was tragically killed at a railroad crossing in 2005. Reportedly, Nicholas and his girlfriend were in their vehicle when it was struck by a train at an unmarked railroad crossing. This dealt a heavy blow to the family and had a major impact on Andrew. Despite the adversity, Andrew went on to graduate from Valley City High School, matriculating at the North Dakota State College of Science in Wahpeton in 2012. He began studying to become an electrician at the two-year college. During his first year at Dakota State, Andrew was a dedicated student who didn't socialize much. His shy nature had been broken somewhat, but he hadn't fully blossomed into a social butterfly. He enjoyed campus life, though, and the freedom it afforded him, being able to come and go as he pleased, meeting up with friends and spending late nights out. At some point during 2013, Andrew was alleged to have begun selling marijuana. According to reports, Andrew would meet potential buyers in parking lots on campus. A North Dakota law makes it a Class A felony to sell drugs on a college campus. According to the law, the maximum sentence and fine for selling drugs is different depending upon three factors: location, amount, and whether or not a minor was involved. In North Dakota, the sale of any amount is considered a felony, and it comes with a possible sentence of 3 to 10 years and a maximum fine of $20,000. If a minor is used, the minimum sentence rises to 10 years and still a fine of $20,000. If the sale is made within 1,000 feet of a school, including colleges, it becomes a minimum of 20 years and a $20,000 fine. On two separate occasions, Andrew was alleged to have sold marijuana to someone operating as a confidential informant for the police. SEMCA, the Southeast Multi-County Agency, was a drug task force made up of officers from local law enforcement agencies in three counties in Southeast North Dakota: Ransom, Richland, and Sargent counties, as well as Wilkins County in neighboring Minnesota. The task force focused on local drug trades and had a history of converting small-time dealers to confidential informants in order to reduce their charges. Essentially, when they would arrest someone either in possession of or intending to sell marijuana and other drugs, they would be offered a choice. They could go forward with the legal proceedings and face the charges, or they could agree to work with the task force. Under this agreement, they would be asked to wear a wire and to make a certain number of drug purchases. They had to coordinate with law enforcement to witness the purchases and document it. And after an appropriate amount of time had passed, police would arrest the seller and charge him or her. At this point, that dealer may have been offered a space in the program in hopes of moving up the ladder and making larger drug busts. Andrew was certainly not one of the larger dealers the police would be interested in busting. In the first sale on April 4th, 2013, Andrew reportedly sold an eighth of an ounce to the confidential informant for $60. The buy is noted as taking place in lot number 4 of the Dakota State campus. In their second meeting, on April 9th, Andrew allegedly sold the informant a gram for $20. The sale is said to have taken place in April of 2013. Again, this purchase was made in lot number 4. According to the police, after both of these sales were made, they waited an appropriate amount of time in order to protect the identity of the confidential informant, and finally went to talk to Andrew on November 21st, 2013. Upon arriving at his dorm, Andrew was informed that they had reason to believe he had been selling marijuana on campus. Officers asked permission to search his dorm room, and Andrew consented. Following a search, police located an orange plastic grinder with marijuana residue inside. Andrew admitted to the investigators that this was his, and they confiscated it, and told Andrew to come down to the sheriff's department the next day. He was not charged at this time. The next day, November 22nd, on his 20th birthday, Andrew found himself in an interrogation room with Richland County Sheriff's Deputy Jason Weber. Weber informed Andrew that he had sold marijuana on two occasions to confidential informants, and that they had enough evidence to charge him with two Class A felonies for selling marijuana on campus. He was also told that these two charges came with a potential sentence of 40 years and a $40,000 fine. There is camera footage of the conversation between Weber and Andrew. While Weber sits with his back to the camera, Andrew sits on the other side of the table in the small and cramped interrogation room. Andrew is dressed in a heavy blue jacket, a blue hooded sweater, and a black and blue cap. He sits with his fingers laced on the table in front of him and his head tilted down throughout much of the conversation. His answers are short and quiet. Upon entering the room, Weber opens a folder and begins by asking Andrew if his roommate knew that he was selling marijuana. He notes that he had been told that Andrew was interested in cooperating with investigators in order to minimize any possible charges he may be facing. In regard to the felonies and possible prison time, Weber adds, quote, "Obviously, you're not going to get 40 years, but is it a good possibility you're going to get prison time if you don't help yourself out? If you don't help yourself out, yeah, there is. That's probably not a way to start off a young adult life. What I'm going to ask for you to do is do some buys for me. You're going to have to wear a wire, you're going to have to buy some marijuana from individuals, and then depending upon how you do and so forth, a lot of this could go away," end quote. Weber goes on to tell him that he will likely have to plead guilty to a lesser charge, likely misdemeanor possession of marijuana. He immediately begins asking Andrew if he knows of anyone that he might be able to buy from, people around town or on campus. Andrew notes that there are a few people he can think of, and he gives the names over to the officer. Those names have been redacted from the audio. When discussing one individual, Andrew explains that this particular person is usually in possession of larger amounts, and he may be able to get 3 to 4 ounces. But Officer Weber dissuades him from this, since it's larger than what he usually purchases, and he doesn't want to arouse the seller's suspicions. Andrew talks about a woman he may be able to buy from, and Weber asks about his roommate and where he gets his weed, to which Andrew responds that he purchases his in Fargo. He doesn't know the dealer's name, but he does have his number. At this point, Weber begins to explain how the process will work. He tells Andrew, quote, "Well, I'll sign you up, and it's up to you to make your own contacts from there. You know you've got two felonies hanging over your head, So we're going to look at probably doing each individual we do, we have to do two deals on, okay? So you've got to do two deals per individual, and then we're going to be looking at probably three or four individuals that you're going to have to do. Is that fair enough? End quote. According to an official report released by the Sheriff's Department, Andrew would have been required to purchase twice from three individuals. According to them, and in the video you can see, Andrew agrees to the deal. Weber tells Andrew that they have some time to get the deals done, but that he doesn't want to stretch it all the way out to the summer. He'd like to finish before Andrew completes his next semester of classes. Weber then begins going over the paperwork with Andrew, telling him how everything works, giving him some papers to sign off on as he reads out the rules of the arrangement. Included on his paperwork is a warning that he cannot hold the state of North Dakota liable for any injuries he may sustain during his time as a confidential informant, and that he is to tell absolutely no one about his association with Weber. Even if he gets arrested, he is not to mention that he is working as a confidential informant. Weber also goes on to give Andrew an explanation of what entrapment is, and that he is not to do anything in regard to his being an informant which could be construed as entrapment. Andrew expresses some concern about whether or not the people he informs on will know that he was the one who turned them in. Weber explains that they wait a certain amount of time before making the arrest, and he tells Andrew that just the way Andrew has no idea who turned him in, nobody will know when he informs on them. On the other hand, he explains there is the possibility that on any particular bust they make, Andrew may have to testify in court against the dealer. He pads this by explaining that in all of his years working in drug enforcement, he has never seen this happen, but he has to tell him because it's a possibility. At the end of the 25-minute discussion, Weber advises Andrew to try and purchase a quarter ounce, but if he can only get an eighth, that would be fine. He explains that in North Dakota, the amount isn't that important and the charge is the same for selling, but that they do like to try and get larger quantities because it looks good for them. Andrew is let out of the room and is now operating as a confidential informant for the Richland County Sheriff's Department. Over the course of the next 2 months, Andrew would make three purchases of drugs under his confidential informant agreement. In November of 2013, just days after his discussion with Weber, Andrew purchases an eighth of an ounce from an individual, and again this takes place in lot number 4. He paid $60 for this initial buy. The second buy takes place in December, and again an eighth is purchased for $60 from the same seller in the same parking lot. Andrew's third buy involved a different seller, and this time one that he himself didn't know or have any experience with. The individual was identified by the task force, who directed Andrew to try and make a purchase from him. Andrew succeeded, buying another eighth, and once again, in the same parking lot. It is after this purchase that Andrew begins withdrawing from Deputy Weber. During their first discussion, Weber explained to Andrew that it's his responsibility to keep in touch and to check in with him. He tells Andrew that he can text him instead of calling, but that every few days he needs an update of what's going on. He goes on to explain that if Andrew severs the connection prior to fulfilling his deal, warrants will be issued and he will be arrested on the charges he's trying to work off. Andrew acknowledged that he understood this and was willing to cooperate. Deputy Weber has stated that after the third purchase, Andrew ceased contact. Weber attempted to get in touch with him on multiple occasions, but Andrew was not responsive. Andrew still had one last buy to make in order to fulfill his deal with the task force. According to Andrew's family, who were completely unaware of his pending charges or his agreement to act as a confidential informant, at this point in time, Andrew's beginning to set the stage for his life after college. He's traveling around North Dakota looking for work as an electrician, visiting cities such as Bismarck and Grand Forks. Andrew is also said to have begun dating a woman around this time, and that things were looking up for him. The question that authorities had was why he stopped contacting them. They left him messages informing him that he had one more purchase to make before he was clear, and that if he failed to live up to his end of the deal, there would be legal repercussions. But Andrew maintained his silence and failed to contact them back. On the weekend of April 25th and 26th of 2014, Andrew made the trip home from school to visit his parents in Rogers. During that weekend, he spent time with his father and helped tend the cattle herd. According to his parents, there was nothing out of the ordinary, and Andrew didn't appear to be depressed or stressed in any way. Tammy Sadek would later state, quote, "He seemed normal. Nothing was bothering him. He helped my husband work the cows and transfer them to another pasture. I was out of town. He left home about 6 p.m. and told his dad that he had a date. He shook his hand and hugged him goodbye." End quote. He headed back to school on the 26th, and later that night at approximately 10 p.m., he answered a phone call from his mother. Tammy checked in with Andrew to ensure that he'd made it back to campus safely, and they engaged in some short small talk. At one point, they discussed their shared data plan and how it was nearing its monthly limit. When the call ended, they said goodbye and agreed to talk again soon. This would be the last time Andrew's parents would ever hear from him. On the night of April 30th, Andrew made plans to go out with his dorm roommate Drew Kugel. Kugel was reportedly unaware of Andrew's work as a confidential informant and had no reason to suspect him of any illegal activities. The two men joined up with a group of friends and went out for the evening. According to Kugel, the night was uneventful and typical of the nights they spent out with friends. They returned to the dorm, and rather than going to sleep, Andrew and Kugel sat down to watch a movie, which Andrew chose. Following the conclusion of the film, both men said goodnight, and that was the last time Kugel would see Andrew. He awoke the next morning, Wednesday, May 1st, to find Andrew gone. According to Kugel, this wasn't something which concerned him, though oftentimes, Andrew was more forthcoming about his plans. Kugel would state, quote, "I thought maybe he went to see his girlfriend. Usually he would tell me where he was going and see if I wanted to go along." End quote. Kugel began to grow concerned when no one had seen Andrew in any of his classes that Wednesday. When it became late afternoon, and Andrew still hadn't returned, he started getting nervous. He met up with friends on Thursday, May 2nd, asking if anyone had seen or heard from Andrew. No one had, and he hadn't attended any of his classes that day either. Kugel discussed the situation with friends on Friday, May 3rd, and they contacted campus police to report Andrew as a missing person. Campus police notified the local police, who began investigating. They uncovered surveillance camera footage showing Andrew, dressed in blue jeans, a black and red Tampa Bay Buccaneers football sweater, blue and orange Nike shoes, and a black and silver backpack, exiting his dorm at approximately 2 a.m. on May 1st. In the video, he appears to be alone, and there are no signs or indications that anyone is nearby or following him. It has also been noted his cell phone was on him at the time, but it had been powered off. The Richland County Sheriff's Department led the investigation and conducted foot, air, and canine unit searches around campus and town, but were unable to pick up on any signs of Andrew. An anonymous tip was called in, describing a sighting of Andrew in the Tyler, North Dakota area, but follow-up searches turned up no new leads. Interestingly, at this point in time, while Andrew's friends and family are deeply concerned that something bad has happened to him, the Richland County Sheriff's Department has a different point of view. While his parents are not aware, authorities do know that Andrew has been avoiding his duty as a confidential informant, and they begin putting together a theory that he may have chosen to flee in order to avoid possible charges due to his failure to live up to his end of the deal. It has been hotly debated in the public forum as to whether or not this negatively impacted their search efforts, as many believe that, thinking he was fleeing, the police were not exploring his disappearance as a missing person case, but rather a fleeing felon situation. As early as Monday, May 5th, just 4 days after his disappearance, the Richland County Sheriff's Department issued a warrant for the arrest of Andrew Sadek. The warrant officially goes public on Friday, May 9th, and specifies that Andrew is wanted for 2 counts of delivery of a controlled substance. It is at this point that Andrew's parents learn of his legal troubles, and they are both taken aback by the fact that he had kept such a secret, but also angry with the police for not telling them earlier. It's unknown at what point they become aware that Andrew has been operating as a confidential informant for the Sheriff's Department, but they have been very outspoken against the practice of using college students to conduct these types of dangerous activities. Sergeant Steve Helgson of the campus police informed the media about the warrant, and suggested that it is possible Andrew chose to flee from his charges. Over the next 2 months, despite heavy searching and a large coalition of community volunteers, including classmates of Andrew's, no trace of him is located. Police note that they have searched all around Wahpeton, including the river, but have been unsuccessful in locating Andrew. They conduct interviews with his friends and family, but no one has any idea where Andrew could have gone, nor did they have any indication that he was planning to go anywhere. Police also spoke to his new girlfriend, but she too is unable to assist and has no idea where he has gone. Tammy and John Sadek went on television and pleaded with Andrew to come home, and for anyone who might have information to come forward. When asked about whether or not Andrew would have fled, Tammy doesn't believe so. She states, quote, "He loved school there, he loved his teachers, he loved his roommates," end quote. She further states that she doesn't believe Andrew left of his own volition, and in fact believes someone abducted Andrew, saying, quote, "It's been my gut feeling from the start," end quote. On Friday, June 27th, nearly 2 months after he disappeared, police discovered Andrew's body. During a routine training assignment, a police dive team came upon his remains in the Red River near Breckenridge, Minnesota. Breckenridge is less than a mile from Wahpeton, just across the state line between North Dakota and Minnesota. The Red River itself is just inside the Minnesota state line, making the driving distance between Wahpeton and the Red River less than 15 minutes. The discovery of his body immediately raises questions as to whether or not Andrew was murdered, committed suicide, or if this is a case of an accidental drowning. An autopsy is conducted, and the results are released 2 months later in August of 2014, but the autopsy itself seems to raise more questions than answers. A dental match was necessary to identify Andrew's body due to decomposition in the river. The autopsy showed that his cause of death was a small caliber gunshot wound to the head. At the time of the autopsy, it could not be determined whether or not the gunshot wound was self-inflicted or not. Initially, police report that Andrew was wearing the black and silver backpack he had been seen wearing on the surveillance footage and the same clothes he had been wearing when he exited from his dorm. It is also reported that Andrew's wallet is missing. The details of his body and clothing change, though, when Tammy Sadek becomes angry about the suicide theory. In an interview with a radio station, conducted the same day the autopsy report is revealed, Tammy states, quote, "There was no suicidal tendencies, there was no note, there was no depression, and his grades were excellent. Who shoots themselves in the head and fills their backpack with rocks, ties them to themselves, and ends up in the river? It's just too much," end quote. Tammy revealed details of the discovery of Andrew's body that the police had not made public. In addition to her statement, Tammy explains that the backpack Andrew was wearing when his body was discovered was full of rocks, and not only did he have his arms through the straps, but the bag was actually tied to his body as if someone were attempting to weigh it down in the river. In addition to this, Andrew's clothing was in fact not what he was last seen wearing in the surveillance footage. His red and black Buccaneers hooded sweater was missing, and strangely, he was wearing a jacket that none of his friends nor family members could identify as belonging to him. To support a possible suicide theory, police point out the fact that sometime after the discovery of his body, the Sadek family found that a .22-caliber pistol was missing from the family home. They believe it is entirely possible that Andrew procured the pistol while visiting his parents the weekend before he vanished, while his family argues that the rocks in the backpack and the theft of his wallet were efforts made by the murderer in an attempt to conceal the body and make identification difficult. In December of 2014, Tammy further revealed what she believes is evidence of a homicide. Within days of his disappearance, Andrew's parents were given possession of his car, which was still parked on campus. Upon taking the vehicle, Tammy has said, quote, "There were several inches of water in the spare tire wheel well," end quote. She further says that the carpeting in the trunk was soaking wet, which leads her to believe that her son was murdered and placed inside of his own trunk before being driven to the river, and that the water was a result of the perpetrator cleaning out the trunk afterwards. According to Tammy, a witness came forward and told her that on the night of Andrew's disappearance, She saw three men washing out the trunk of a car, which bore a striking similarity to Andrew's. Unfortunately, surveillance cameras near Andrew's car were not functioning at that time. Tammy and John Sadek request that North Dakota's Attorney General Wayne Stengem investigate the task force and the way in which it handled Andrew, as well as suggesting possible links to Andrew's murder and one of the men on whom he may have informed. A panel was assembled of three longtime law enforcement officers, and the case was reviewed, though little fault was found with the way the task force handled Andrew. Wahpeton Police Chief Scott Thorstenson stated, quote, "These types of investigations are conducted the same way pretty much everywhere where people are breathing in and out. They never did anything wrong that needed to be changed," end quote. The official review would go on to suggest that the task force be placed under the control of an agent from the Bureau of Criminal Investigation, and after the review, it was. In response to the review, Tammy Sadek stated, quote, "He was murdered. This report actually reinforces that in our minds. We know that, and we know they're not even looking at anything. Did somebody he was trying to get for them do it? Or somebody he'd already gotten? They're still using kids. They're not protecting these kids," end quote. The death of Andrew Sadek is suggested to not have been an isolated case, and that police mishandling of confidential informants, or at least their inability to properly protect them, has led to other deaths. Rachel Hoffman was a 23-year-old Florida State University graduate who was murdered on May 7, 2008, while performing as a confidential drug informant. Much like Andrew, Rachel was arrested when marijuana was found in her possession during a traffic stop. A later search of her apartment led to the discovery of more marijuana and four ecstasy pills. Faced with heavy drug charges, Rachel was given three options. She could face the charges and take her chances in court. She could name other drug dealers and give vital information for their arrest. Or she could act as a confidential informant and make some drug purchases. Rachel went with the latter and was sent to make a rather large purchase. The goal was for Rachel to acquire 1,500 ecstasy pills, 2 ounces of cocaine, and 2 handguns, using $13,000 provided to her by the police department. During the buy, Rachel was monitored by undercover officers, but things went south when the sellers recommended changing the location of the deal. They asked her to get in their car with them, and they would take her to the site of the sale. She had previously been informed not to follow or travel with the suspects, but eager to eliminate her charges and satisfy the police, she got into the suspect's stolen BMW. Law enforcement lost track of her, and during the drive, Rachel was shot with one of the 2 guns she was meant to be buying, and her body was discovered 2 days later. 2 suspects were arrested, charged, and convicted for her murder. As a result of her murder, Rachel's family filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the city, and the police were forced to admit that Rachel had been given no training to work undercover, that she had never before met the 2 men targeted in the buy, that she had no experience with cocaine or firearms, and very little experience with ecstasy. The officers in charge were ultimately suspended, with pay. As a result of this terrible incident, on May 7, 2009, Florida passed a law called Rachel's Law, which requires law enforcement agencies to give special training to people recruited as confidential informants, inform potential informants that their cooperation does not necessarily guarantee a reduction in charges, and permits informants to request a lawyer at any point if they so desire. Many people have tried to draw a link between the death of Andrew Sadek and the death of Thomas Bearson. Both men were students in North Dakota. Both bodies were found across the state line in Minnesota. Both men were murdered within 4 months of each other, and many believe both men were acting as confidential informants for North Dakota law enforcement agencies. A direct link is impossible to make, but the similarities are difficult to discount. However, without further evidence, it's impossible to prove that Bearson was a confidential informant like Andrew was. Neither murder has been solved, and many argue that neither case received the proper attention it deserved from law enforcement. This has brought up a large debate about the use of college students as confidential informants, and as in the case of Rachel Hoffman, Andrew's parents have worked hard to change the laws in North Dakota. In 2016, Tammy and John Sadek filed a lawsuit against the state of North Dakota, as well as Sheriff's Deputy Jason Weber, stating that they failed to reasonably supervise Andrew. In regard to the lawsuit, attorney Tim O'Keefe, speaking on behalf of the family, stated, quote, "We filed the lawsuit today, 2 years from the day Andrew's body was discovered, hoping to achieve accountability for those who put Andrew in harm's way," end quote. The Sadeks are suing for economic damages, including the cost of the memorial, and non-economic damages related to mental anguish, emotional distress, grief, and loss of companionship. When asked about the lawsuit, Tammy stated, quote, "A lawsuit is not the North Dakota way, but this is our last grasp at hoping to get some answers," end quote. As of early 2017, the lawsuit is still in motion, though the state and attorneys for Weber attempted to have a gag order placed on the Sadeks and their attorney to stop them from publicizing any information they may gain through the lawsuit, as it may negatively impact the investigation or possibly taint the jury pool. The judge declined this motion. In 2017, Andrew's Law was signed into law in North Dakota. It stipulated that law enforcement must train confidential informants and that, quote, "reasonable protective measures," end quote, be granted to them. It also requires a written acknowledgement that the informant may speak with an attorney and stop working with law enforcement at any time during the agreement. It also prohibits the use of informants under the age of 15 and disallows campus police from using confidential informants. It also requires the Attorney General to authorize an independent investigation in the event that a confidential informant dies. There are four essential theories revolving around the death of Andrew Sadek. Of those four, two are considered to be more likely than others, and the two which have been put forward by police on one side and Andrew's parents on the other. The first theory revolves around Andrew's new girlfriend. She was the only person new to Andrew's life, and the only one the family and friends knew very little about, although Tammy would refer to her as, quote, "the sweetest thing ever," end quote. There appears to be no motive. Although a crime revolving around a relationship isn't entirely new or impossible, but this theory is often dismissed because authorities state that they have spoken to this woman and ruled her out as a possibility. Despite my sincerest efforts, I was unable to find her name. Both police and Andrew's parents do not consider her a likely suspect, though it's considered a possibility by many others. Unfortunately, with such a thin amount of information, it's nearly impossible to appropriately address this theory other than to list it as a theory. The next theory is one which the police have suggested almost since the beginning, that Andrew committed suicide. Theories abound about why exactly Andrew would have chosen to take his own life, but many believe it could have been a combination of factors, as it often is. Many believe that Andrew felt overwhelmed by his role as a confidential informant, and possibly even guilty for turning others in the way he had been, and made the decision to stop participating, not because he was going to go to jail, but because he was going to commit suicide. Under this theory, Andrew's visit to his parents' ranch on the weekend before his disappearance was likely a way of saying goodbye, and to take the missing .22 caliber pistol with which he would kill himself. Of course, there are pieces which don't fit. Andrew was 2 weeks away from graduating and had been taking steps to finding a job and planning out his future. He had begun dating someone and spent his last night hanging out with friends having fun. Most people don't view these actions as those of a suicidal person, and if anything, they show plans for the future rather than disregard for it. One of the biggest questions is why the backpack was full of rocks. Even if Andrew had made the choice to commit suicide, why would he go through the extra step of weighing himself down with rocks in order to conceal his body? It just doesn't connect for many people. Police certainly considered suicide a likely option, though Andrew's parents firmly disagreed. Since almost the moment that they learned their son was missing, John and Tammy have been very outspoken against the suicide theory and have believed that Andrew was murdered. The murder theory branches off into three possible lists of suspects: a drug dealer that Andrew informed on, a random act of violence, or a police officer. Random act of violence is always a possibility, and Andrew could have run into anyone that late night on the streets of Wapton. It's certainly plausible that he could have become the victim of a robbery gone wrong, which would explain his missing wallet, or even someone who was out looking to commit a murder. The idea that it could have been retribution for Andrew narking on a dealer is certainly plausible. Drugs are a dangerous game, and it's not entirely unlikely that someone may have learned about what Andrew was doing and decided to strike against him. If this was the case, you'd have to believe police would have looked very closely at the people he made deals with. But again, we don't know how closely they examined this case from the perspective of a homicide rather than a suicide. The final branch is that Andrew may have been murdered by a police officer. Many have theorized that Andrew may have seen or heard something he wasn't meant to, and perhaps this is why he chose to walk away as an informant, and someone felt it necessary to kill him in order to cover it up. That is remarkably speculative, but in this case, with no suspects, no concrete motive, and no real evidence, speculation is all we have. So what happened to Andrew Sadek? A young college student primed to graduate and start his new life, he was working with the police as a confidential informant to get himself out from under drug charges, when he suddenly vanishes, and 2 months later his body is pulled from the river, the victim of either a suicide or a homicide. As of this recording, the investigation officially lists the manner of Andrew's death as undetermined, although it is believed to be being looked at as a homicide. In the 3 years since Andrew died, there has been little information released by investigators, and no suspects have ever been questioned. The lawsuit will likely continue to inhibit the release of information regarding this case. John and Tammy succeeded in passing a law to defend others from ending up in the situation that Andrew did, but now seek to feel vindicated in their lawsuit against the state and Deputy Weber. Regardless of the outcome, they will never have their son back, and somewhere, a killer may be walking the streets of Wapton. The death of Andrew Sadek is one of those stories we should never have to hear. A quiet, shy boy in a small town goes off to college, begins to experience the blooming world, and finds himself in a difficult situation because of a stupid decision. In order to make amends for his decision, and to dig himself out of the hole he finds himself at the bottom of, he makes a deal that can clear his name and allow him to move forward with his life without having to have it irreparably damaged due to his poor choices. In many cases, others have been in this situation before, made the same deal, and walked away with a second chance, although in some cases, it did not work out that well. Whether or not they used that second chance to its fullest, or relapsed back into their criminal behavior can't be truly measured, but in the case of Andrew Sadek, 6 months after he signs his name on the dotted line, he vanishes without a trace and is later found dead. This case brings up a lot of different topics which are often debated. I don't want to get bogged down in the politics of all of it. Marijuana and its legal status is frequently discussed. Some states have chosen to legalize it, others have become more strict in the enforcement of its sale and possession. In almost every state, it's considered especially criminal to distribute marijuana near or in a school zone, and this includes college campuses. If someone is arrested for doing so, they almost always face more prominent charges with longer possible sentences and deeper fines. The law attempts to be black and white about it, although people tend to think in a vast spectrum of colors. Regardless of how you see it, Andrew Sadek did break the law by selling marijuana, and he was facing 2 Class A felonies for doing so. There's no denying this, and this is a simple fact of the case. Many times I've seen this issue being debated, but at the end of the day, this is a case about a young man losing his life, and I don't want to lose sight of that. This is about Andrew Sadek, and not a forum for debating the legality of marijuana. In regard to the confidential informant laws, I do think the changes made need to be made in more places. I think it's in the best interest of everyone involved for confidential informants to be trained and properly looked after. Unfortunately, this debate sometimes overpowers the case itself, and Andrew's name gets lost in the shuffle of politics and law. At the end of the day, a young man is dead, and there are no answers as to why or how. Strangely, this isn't a case that I've seen splashed all over the headlines. I thought it would be. It has so many aspects that typically draw the media in. A young man caught up in a world of drugs gets arrested and agrees to work as a confidential informant for the police. Within 6 months of his signing this agreement, He vanishes and is found months later in a river with a bullet in his head and a backpack full of rocks strapped to his body. There have been news articles, and Andrew's parents have been very outspoken in interviews, but outside of a small spot on an episode of 60 Minutes, this case has received almost no real coverage. It's absolutely baffling what happened here, and the confusion about the fate of Andrew Sadek is only made deeper when the police and his parents begin a very public debate about what exactly occurred. Initially, nobody knows the true extent to which Andrew was connected to the Richland Sheriff's Department in terms of his time as a confidential informant. But as the details begin to emerge, not only are his parents shocked by this revelation, but they're further appalled when, rather than addressing this as a disappearance, the Sheriff's Department issues warrants for his arrest. After the discovery of his body, police hint towards a possible suicide, and Andrew's parents firmly believe that their son was murdered. They lost their first son 10 years earlier, and now they're left with no children, and they want answers, and they want justice. There are theories, and each has its supporters and detractors, but at the end of the day, Andrew Sadek died for no good reason, and the lack of answers only makes it that much more difficult to accept. Autopsy results show that Andrew sustained a low-caliber gunshot wound to the head, which was ultimately the cause of death. They find that he had likely been killed within 48 hours of his disappearance. Strangely, they announced publicly that he'd been wearing the same clothes he had on when he disappeared, but Tammy contradicts that, stating that he no longer had his hoodie on and instead was wearing a jacket which was unfamiliar. Police theorize about a possible suicide, considering a small caliber handgun was missing from his parents' ranch, and he was in emotional turmoil regarding the status of his case with the police. Tammy disagrees and releases further information that Andrew's backpack had been found on his back as well as tied to him and was full of rocks to weigh his body down. So what exactly happened to Andrew? There are a lot of questions I have regarding the way in which his body was found. The backpack is a fascinating detail, but I've always wondered, are we talking 3 or 4 large rocks or a large quantity of small rocks? It seems like an innocuous detail, but I don't believe a killer would take the time gathering up small rocks. So if it were larger rocks, I feel that would be more confirmation of a murder, whereas with smaller rocks, I feel it's possible Andrew could have taken the time to fill his bag and really think about what he was planning to do. In regard to why police released different information about his clothing, there could be a lot of reasons. But if they did suspect homicide, they may have wanted to retain that information to use while questioning a suspect in the future. I don't put a lot of interest into the jacket, as it's not unlikely that Andrew could have purchased a new jacket that no one had seen before, and perhaps that is what was in his backpack when he left the dorm. Unfortunately, we have no way of knowing, and whatever information police did discover in relation to his clothing, they have yet to release it. That essentially brings us to the theories. And the first theory is that Andrew's death had something to do with the woman he was dating. There are a million different ways this theory could come together. Maybe she was mad at Andrew and they got into a fight and he was shot during a moment of anger. Maybe she had other boyfriends or a jealous ex who may have known Andrew and wanted to get revenge. There are way too many loose ends when it comes to this theory, so I have to defer to both the police and Andrew's parents. The police say they questioned this woman, but that she was not considered a suspect. Andrew's mother, his biggest proponent throughout this entire ordeal, agrees that the girlfriend was not a viable suspect. So if she wasn't tied to what happened to him, who else could have been? There is the possibility of a random act of violence. Andrew left the dorm around 2 a.m., and there's definitely a plausible theory that he may have run into one or more unsavory characters. His wallet was missing, which helps with this theory as it's entirely possible we're looking at a robbery gone wrong. Perhaps he came across someone who intended to rob him, pointed a gun at him, and made him get into a car. The suspect drives him down to the river and, for one reason or another, decides to kill him. This is where the backpack would come into play. The killer could easily have stuffed a few rocks into his bag, tied the bag to his body, and threw him in the river. I have to say, I think there's a good possibility here that Andrew was murdered by a random person, and possibly someone who lived in the area. The perpetrator would have known the location of the river and felt comfortable enough with it to bring Andrew down there. Typically, a killer isn't going to bring someone to a place he's never been on the off chance that he might get away with it. If this is the case, then the killer could have either went back to town and continued to live locally, or perhaps it was a drifter. I do find it interesting that the river is so close to the border of North Dakota and Minnesota, and I wonder if it's possible that the killer lived in Minnesota. Unfortunately, this aspect of the case is where everything falls apart, as so few details have been revealed. Without having the evidence, I have to say that I think a random act of violence is a good possibility. Another theory is that Andrew's status as a confidential informant was discovered, and one of the dealers from whom he bought had killed him. This is absolutely a possibility, and a high one on the list. Andrew was 20 years old when he became a confidential informant, and though he was concerned about people learning his identity, it's not completely out of the realm of possibility to believe he may have told someone. Maybe a friend he trusted, maybe it came out when he was partying. However it happened, it's possible, and when something like that comes out, people tend to spread it around. There's also the possibility that the person who informed on Andrew may have told someone about it, and then when Andrew came around looking to make buys, they got suspicious. I've always believed that the backpack Andrew was wearing the night he disappeared is connected to his murder. I can't help but wonder if there were drugs or money in that bag. I don't believe he randomly elected to go out at 2 a.m. I think he was meeting someone for some reason. If that is the case, whoever it is who lured him out that night is almost certainly responsible for his murder. There's also the strange detail that when he left, his cell phone was turned off. Was this so he couldn't be tracked, or was his phone just dead? Interestingly, there is no mention of whether or not his phone was recovered when they found his body. Tammy said that she was told by an anonymous witness that she had seen three men who appeared to be washing a car that looked similar to Andrew's the night he disappeared. Tammy believes these men likely shot Andrew, put him in the trunk, drove him to the river, and tossed him in, then drove his car back. I find this to be a difficult part of the theory to swallow. Firstly, it's based off an anonymous witness who spoke to Tammy, and I have no evidence to suggest this witness ever spoke to the police. In addition to this, why would they have washed his car when they came back? That is much more likely to have drawn attention. They could have easily just driven the car into the river with him. Maybe they were afraid he would be discovered faster if they did that, but why they were concerned with concealing his body in the first place is curious to me. In a lot of cases, if you're a so-called rat informer, the people who take you out want others to know about it, as a warning. This isn't always the case, but I feel like they wouldn't have gone through the effort to weigh his body down and also clean out the car. I think they were much more likely to have shot Andrew and dumped him in the river and been done with it. It's hard to say for sure, but it's absolutely impossible to ignore the fact that Andrew may have been murdered by somebody he set up in one of those buys. The thing which makes me question this is that the police know everyone he made these buys with. They were there monitoring it and keeping records. You have to believe that they would have thoroughly questioned anyone Andrew dealt with while he was working undercover for them, and to this day they have never revealed a suspect. I think it's a very good possibility, and honestly maybe the most likely one on the list, that Andrew was murdered by someone he was setting up. Some people have suggested that Andrew may have been murdered by one of the police officers he was working with. Much like the girlfriend theory, this takes somewhat of a leap of faith. It certainly wouldn't be the first time a dirty cop did something like this, but I see no evidence to make the connection. Andrew would have had to have been in a very bad situation and have seen or have known something which made a police officer need to eliminate him. The only thing I could see lending any credence to this is the fact that Andrew left his dorm at 2 a.m. that morning, and it's entirely possible he was lured out by someone he trusted. On the other hand, if he had learned something criminal about one of the officers, wouldn't he have been less likely to meet him at such an odd time? Maybe. But if the cop was threatening to file warrants against him, he may have felt that he had to go. I've always thought there was something very strange about the way Andrew was such a cooperative informant, and then out of the blue, right when he's almost done with it all, he stops. What made him stop? And could it be connected to one of the police officers for whom he was working? We may never know, but I can't exactly rule it out as a possibility either. That leaves us with the final theory of suicide. To me, this is an interesting possibility in this case. We have almost as much evidence to support it as we have evidence to contradict it. We know that a .22 caliber gun went missing from his parents' home, and that a small caliber weapon was used to end his life. If he had shot himself while in the river, or in a way in which he could fall into the river, This could explain why the murder weapon was never found. If he didn't want to be found, or he felt shame for what he was doing and wanted to hide, it's very possible that he could have filled his bag with rocks and tied it to himself. But in my experience, suicides don't typically go out of their way to conceal the bodies. When you reach the psychological breaking point where you're willing to end your own life, you don't usually think beyond it. And that's the part of me that makes me question suicide. That, and the fact that Andrew had been starting to date someone and was making plans for the future. These aren't the behaviors of someone who plans to commit suicide, and typically, they push away from those they care about. They don't usually invite others into the fold. We also have his missing wallet. Now, Andrew's wallet could have been lost in the river, just as it's possible that the gun was, and as far as we've been made aware, there's been no activity on his bank account or his social security number, so if someone did steal it, they would have only been going for the cash and then ditched it. Andrew could have even ditched his own wallet somewhere, but why would he? I can absolutely see where the police are coming from with this theory. He was under a lot of pressure, he was in a tough situation, and he had to know that by not working with the police anymore, he was running a high risk of being arrested. So it's possible that it all became too much for him, and he chose to end things. In the years since his death, police seem to have slowly moved away from the suicide theory, and even the manner of death on his death certificate has been changed to undetermined. I consider suicide a possibility, but not the most likely answer to this mystery. The death of Andrew Sadek is a tragic story which has deeply affected not only his family and friends, but the entire state of North Dakota. His parents managed to take their grief and transform it into a new law to protect others who may find themselves in Andrew's position someday in the future, and you have to respect grieving parents who are able to put their pain into action. As for their lawsuit, it remains to be seen what happens, and though I feel for them, and I support them, I don't believe they will come out of it with much of anything unless the state and Deputy Weber choose to settle. According to the review board's report, Andrew was handled no differently from any other confidential informant, and they found no wrongdoing in their actions. That's going to be hard to overcome in a wrongful death lawsuit. This is one of those cases that sticks in my head. It all seems so meaningless, whether it was murder or suicide. Andrew Sadek is gone, and he shouldn't be. He was a bright young man with a good future ahead of him, and in a moment, all of that was taken away. We may never find the answers to this case, and we may never know exactly what happened, but we can hope that if someone was involved in this, they will be revealed and will face justice for what they did. If indeed Andrew took his own life, then we can only hope that his family can find some form of closure and come to peace with the loss of both of their children. The death of Andrew Sadek remains an open investigation, but in the 3 years since, no relevant leads nor suspects have been discovered.
Case update. 2 years after Andrew's death, his family filed a lawsuit against Richland County and its sheriff, Jason Weber. The lawsuit argued that not only had law enforcement failed to train Andrew or offer protection during his work as a confidential informant, but that they had also lied about the potential charges and legal repercussions for his arrest. Weber's lawyer argued that the Sadeks had been very vocal in the media and requested the judge issue a gag order, though ultimately the judge dismissed that motion. In April of 2018, the Sadek's lawyer requested a postponement since neither Andrew's school nor the investigating agencies had provided them with the evidence and files they had requested. That motion was granted. In July of 2019, the Sadek's wrongful death suit was dismissed. Southeast District Judge Jay Schmitz explained his decision, writing in part, quote, "One can only speculate almost endlessly. Was Andrew's death a suicide or homicide? If it was homicide, who did it? What was the killer or killer's motivation? Was Andrew killed during a drug deal? If so, was it related to his role as a confidential informant?" End quote. As of this time, the North Dakota Supreme Court is reviewing the judge's decision to dismiss the case, though no formal decision has yet been determined. A lawyer for the defense, Corey Quinton, told the media, quote, "The undisputed facts of this case are that we will likely never know what, when, where, how, or why," End quote. For the Sadiks, they want justice for their son and an admission that the situation was handled improperly, which may have led to the death of Andrew. Should the Supreme Court reverse the dismissal, the case would be sent to district court. Police say the investigation remains open and active.
If you're interested in finding more information about the death of Andrew Sadik, there are several news reports, forums, and a 60-minute episode which discuss it. I will also be posting the link to the interrogation video on the website and in the Facebook group. If you have any information about the death of Andrew Sadik, please contact the Richland County Sheriff's Department or your local police. What do you think happened to Andrew Sadik? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. I want to invite you to check out our website at trace-evidence.com. You can find links to our Patreon, all of our social media accounts, as well as places to download and subscribe to the podcast. I'm always eager to hear your feedback. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a good rating on iTunes and leave us a review. This will greatly help our reach and bring more attention to the cases we cover. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.